to excess.
Yes, the human tendency, but specifically the tendencies of the monarchy and aristocracy, because they were the excesses that you had the best view of, principally in Europe. But they were well aware of the problems you could have with mobs.
So how were these views of excess and the need to check it enshrined in the design of the American system?
Well, in the beginning, the interpretation of how we would elect the president was that essentially it'd be elected by the states and by electors who didn't get chosen by the people. In other words, you didn't have a democratic election of the president at first. The Senate was there to check the popular branch, which was the House. There wasn't really a full-blown sense of the judiciary for the first 10, 15 years after the Constitution was put into effect. They were certainly concerned about the military. There was always a very small army, a little bit more of a navy, but not much. There wasn't a belief that we needed much government, and that was reflected in another suspicion that too much government was bad, because if there was too much of it, it would be working for the rich and for the powerful.
So that's the theory. Looking at America today, how well is our system of checks and balances functioning?
I don't think the system is working terribly well. There have been an awful lot of organizations and conferences in the last 30 or 40 years about ways in which the system isn't working very well, or ways in which we don't elect the president very well. Witness the 2000 election, a number of concerns about the Electoral College, a number of concerns about the two-party system, and whether or not that wasn't losing its great success of previous eras. So I think that there is a sense among a lot of people that the American system at this point isn't fulfilling a lot of the roles that it fulfilled when it was newer and it was younger and it wasn't encrusted with such a long period of evolution in which the structure got intermingled with the power elites and with the lobbies and with the people who had money. In Washington today, the whole city is a lobby. There's a street in Washington called K Street, which is just like Lobbyist Row, law firms and lobbies and consultants and what have you. And they control much more about Washington than the average American back in a congressional district.
This is the intersection of 17th and K Streets in Washington, D.C. The lobbying industry here vies for influence on government policies ranging from health care to warfare, and especially on decisions about who will receive funds from the federal budget of nearly $3 trillion. Lobbyists by the tens of thousands wage a relentless campaign to schmooze with or to pressure members of Congress and federal officials. Also here on K Street is the Center for Public Integrity, where researcher Alex Knott keeps tabs on the army of lobbyists. Do average citizens have any chance of being heard?
Oftentimes they don't. It's really because of the money, and let me explain why. Well, Chamber of Commerce, for instance, right? They had more than 100 lobbyists working for them in 2004 alone. So did Altria and a bunch of other companies. Lockheed Martin had more than 100 lobbyists working for them. The number one defense contractor. During the years in which they spent $54 million lobbying the federal government, they received $94 billion in defense contracts.
Pretty good investment.
Sure. It's less than a penny on the dollar. And not only that, 74.6% of those contracts were no-bid contracts. So when you hear about Halliburton and all the contracts that they've received in no-bid contracts, it's nothing in comparison to a company like Lockheed Martin, which received more than $60 billion in no-bid contracts. You know, this happens a lot with the Department of Defense. And we found that $362 billion has been spent by DOD in no-bid contracts. To put that in another way, it's $1,000 for every man, woman, and child living in the United States in no-bid contracts.
Help me to understand a kind of breakdown by proportion of the industries that are investing in this lobbying.
Well, really what it's reflective of is not Capitol Hill, but Wall Street. The biggest companies that are spending large amounts lobbying are some of America's Fortune 500. You have defense companies like Lockheed Martin. But the number one industry out there is the pharmaceutical industry, which has spent more than $600 million lobbying since 1998. But then you have electric and utilities companies. Oil and gas is one of the top ones, in the top eight. So when everybody's thinking about the amount of money that they're paying at the pump, you have to realize that the top three companies that make up the oil and gas companies have spent more than $100 million just between the three of them. And almost each one of them has lobbied either the Federal Trade Commission or the SEC, two organizations, federal agencies, that would be able to stop any type of situation where incorrect profits are being reported or any situation where price gouging or monopolies were intact.
The federal budget pie is carved up here in the U.S. Capitol building, crowned by its magnificent white dome atop a hill. Could George Washington, who laid the cornerstone, possibly have imagined the sheer scale of budgets allocated here today by Congress under the sway of moneyed interests? Alex Knott.
The biggest companies are acting to ensure their profits. That's basically what's happening. You've got millions and millions of dollars that are being spent to protect billions, and sometimes over the course of various industries, up to trillions of dollars that are being protected.
These are just mind-boggling numbers. It would take a long time just to count up the number of zeros in $1 trillion.
Sure.
And for the average person, this is just completely beyond the scope of what any of us is familiar with in our daily life. Stepping back, Alex, what is the big picture of all this money being bombarded at Congress, at members of Congress through these various systems of getting to know people and socialize with them and have access to them? Is it simply a massive bribery system? Is it a legitimate exercise of democracy?
Actually, it's a little bit of all of that. In some ways, it is the legalization of the old boys network. There's $2.1 billion going in to pay for people that are well-connected and good friends of the key lawmakers and regulators that are out there, whether they be somebody from the cabinet or one of the top congressmen that are out there. It's also a situation where it's protected by the First Amendment to petition the federal government. There's definitely some shades of gray in there. For every Philip Morris / Altria that's out there that's in charge of cigarettes and selling cigarettes, you've got an American Cancer Society. And to restrict one would be restricting the other's free speech. And these things are protected under the First Amendment.
If you're saying it's basically not improper, it's protected free speech, it's a way in which interest groups of various stripes are able to be heard. In that sense, what is the loss here?
I think possibly the loss is what falls between the cracks. If you don't have a moneyed interest pushing on a bill, it's going to be difficult for that to be heard over the hundreds of lobbyists that are pushing their specific issue, pushing their specific amendment, sometimes writing the legislation that's there. The biggest thing out there is probably the federal deficit. The federal deficit will affect generations of Americans going forward, whether it deals with credit or the amount of money that they actually have to pay out. And we're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars.
Acutely worrisome to a growing consensus of both liberals and conservatives is the runaway train of national debt. Record federal expenditures combined with massive tax cuts favoring the wealthy have produced a stack of IOUs now totaling more than $8 trillion. That's over $25,000 per person in America. It's hard to conceive of a more vivid illustration that something has broken down. You're listening to Checks and Balances, a Humankind special. I'm David Freudberg. For more information, visit our website, humanmedia.org.
I've come here on a bustling morning to New York City's Park Avenue to find out how the subject of checks and balances is seen by a fat cat. At least that's how Peter Peterson describes himself. a man of unimpeachable conservative Republican credentials. Pete Peterson served as U.S. Secretary of Commerce and chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. His office looks out on Manhattan from the 31st floor of this skyscraper, where he chairs the Blackstone Group, a large investment house. We used to hear a lot about the trickle-down theory, which said if the wealthiest people are taxed less, they'll have more money to spend, and those purchases ultimately benefit people at the bottom. Lately, I've been hearing the phrase trickle up, that the poor and many in the working class are losing ground, while at the top, the people have gained. Is that fair?
You know, far be it from a merchant banker in the middle of this to play moralist and try to define what fair is. I guess I've been surprised that it's sustainable. I'm nearly 80 years old, been around a long time. I have never seen this kind of distribution of income in the United States.
While the minimum wage has not increased in nearly a decade, the costs of health care, housing, gasoline, and tuition have soared. Since the year 2000, millions more Americans have slipped below the poverty line. Meanwhile, according to IRS data, 43% of the benefit of recent tax cuts went to the top tenth of America's wealthiest 1%. The rich have gotten richer. Former Commerce Secretary Pete Peterson.
In New York, you see it with the most extravagant expenditures on fancy apartments that are selling for, you know, $30, $40, and $50 million. Modern paintings that have tripled in only 2 or 3 years. People competing over who can have the biggest airplane and, you know, of their own and so forth.
So are you witnessing in the echelons you travel in an absolute orgy of extravagance?
Well, again, that's a moral judgment. I was brought up in the Depression. My father used to consider a big spender the ultimate pejorative. He had to pay off his mortgage in 18 months after buying his house for $5,000. He saved everything.
I've spent a lot of time in the last decade going back and looking at the previous leading world powers.
Historian Kevin Phillips.
One thing that almost always was true was that you had an increasing proportion of wealth at the top, a gap between the people at the top and everybody else, and kind of a sense that wealth controlled and there wasn't much you could do about it. And these very wealthy societies that are top-heavy and get too much in love with themselves and so forth and lose their judgment have been part of what pulled down these previous world powers. The Britain that made so many mistakes at the beginning of World War I was one of the most polarized, richest at the top 1% societies the world has ever seen. That's the masterpiece theater England that we see, the Edwardian England of people living in the wonderful houses with 15 servants and so forth. These societies don't work out as well. It's not good to have that concentration historically.
Adding to the sense of a gathering storm are America's demographics. The impending retirement of tens of millions of baby boomers has sparked a national discussion over the future health of Social Security and Medicare. Economists debate whether the system will burst or survive with minor adjustments. Either way, a surge in the elderly population will place a strain on America at a time when the country's massive debt load reduces our flexibility to respond.
Well, I've been a Republican all my life, and I've been really puzzled by some developments in Washington. You recall it was in the 90s when a Democratic president, of all things, sat down with a Republican Congress, and together they worked out a system of restraints. They had something called spending caps. They had something called pay-as-you-go rules, where if you had a tax cut, you'd have to reduce spending. And in the 90s, we had a kind of a golden period, at least by my standards. The budget deficit disappeared. We had surpluses. Those mechanisms worked wonderfully, and they were bipartisan.
In his book, Running on Empty, Peterson notes with some irony that deficit restraints all but collapsed during the presidency of George W. Bush, when Republicans, traditionally the party of fiscal conservatism, controlled both the White House and Congress.
What Congress has given, the Congress should not take away. For the sake of job growth, the tax cuts you passed should be permanent.
In my party, we have something called the tax cut enthusiasts, who have not met a tax cut they didn't like. The Democrats, on the other hand, have got a kind of mentality of never having met a universal entitlement that they didn't want to either create or expand. So we have this kind of conspiracy or collusion of the two parties that send out a message that may be societal, really, that it's never the correct time for anybody to give up anything for the long-term general good. And we're all gain and no pain. There was a German philosopher named Dietrich Bonhoeffer who once said the ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world it leaves to its children. And something that bothers me more than a little, who do we think we're passing these debts on?
Politics delivers generally now for those who have money or those who have the organized interest groups on their side, which again generally means money.
Kevin Phillips is author of American Theocracy.
Now, one of the reasons this can happen is that a major portion of the United States, especially in the South, which is the most religious part of the country, is caught up in this sense of salvation, of religious end times, of all of these issues. And that instead of being the force for economic change that they were under William Jennings Bryan and during the 1930s under FDR in the South, everything from the Tennessee Valley Authority to all the agricultural programs and tenant farmer legislation, now they don't want to get involved. Their concern is about salvation. They're waiting for the second coming. The theologians have written about this. And in a sense, this helps create this concentration at the top because people who have historically been part of the populist element in American elections are basically sitting there thinking about religion.
The large U.S. evangelical Christian movement formed a partnership with President George W. Bush that leaves a striking imprint on America's cultural and political landscape. Comprised mostly of social conservatives, it's a population that holds deep values, honoring the traditional family and a duty to be charitable. President Bush has carefully cultivated this constituency.
Religious charities of every creed are doing some of the most vital work in our country. Mentoring children, feeding the hungry, taking the hand of the lonely. By executive order, I've opened billions of dollars in grant money to competition that includes faith-based charities.
In what ways do you see erosion of the boundary between church and state now?
Well, I think that what we saw back during the 60s and 70s was that people had too little a sense of the importance of religion in the United States. And they had this notion that you could squeeze religion further out of the system. People thought that you could move prayer out of the schools. Now, I think you can in many ways, but it's probably best to allow a certain degree of flexibility in places in the South where everybody agrees on it. Nobody thought it was a big deal, and the fact that they had a prayer once a week didn't matter. What probably happened in the 60s and 70s, by my view, and you have to remember that I started out as a political conservative, was that the liberals went way too far in thinking that religion just wasn't important and you could move in a secular direction. And as they did that, they produced this growing backlash. And slowly but surely, people became clear that they wanted religion to have more of a role. And George W. Bush played to that very much because he had been born again during the 1980s and he had this sense of himself as playing a role in restoring traditional values in religion. And when he was running for president in 1999, he told meetings of preachers that he thought God wanted him to run for president. And by the time George W. Bush got in, and then 9/11 came along, which to him was almost a religious experience, he thought again that he was sort of chosen to lead the country in response to this breakdown that created a contest between good and evil.
How do you reconcile so many leaders professing Christianity at a time when the poor are getting poorer? The life of Jesus was not one that would advocate the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer.
Well, they profess a type of Christianity which is principally concerned at this point with the unfolding of the end times and personal salvation. So you've got two competing sort of visible poles of this interpretation. You've got the liberals who say, but Jesus was concerned about the poor and toppling the Pharisees and taking Christianity away from the churchmen, and that's all true by a lot of yardsticks. But the people who are thinking about the end times and really caught up in that, they have a different view of what Christianity was. It's now at this crisis stage. I'm not sure in the religious sense, but I certainly do feel that a lot of Americans and a lot of other people have the sense that the world is moving towards some kind of climax, whether it be in the environment or in nuclear weaponry or in oil. And I do, too. I have the sense that...
Disease,
even perils of the natural kind, like tsunamis and changing weather. All of this, to me, is cause for the concern that this time it's different. So I can see why it's a little different here.
You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Steve Colby. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal. Special thanks to Capital News Connection, Jeffrey White, and Kathy Graham. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with The Network Incorporated. Program development and support provided by Chart Media.
We're distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
This segment, part one of Checks and Balances, is Humankind program number 105 from PRI Public Radio International. Coming up in a minute in the second half of Humankind, we continue our examination of checks and balances in America today with a look at the functioning of our fourth estate, the medium of news coverage. Longtime White House correspondent Helen Thomas offers a no-holes-barred view of government spin in the age of mass media. And Kevin Phillips believes our media slept leading up to the war in Iraq. When Humankind continues in a moment. Support for this Public Radio International program comes from the Humankind Program Fund, this station and PRI stations nationwide, and from the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation.
Whenever I walk by Independence Hall and sort of birthplace of our country, what I'm struck by now are the security precautions that exist because of the fear, and I'm struck by the fact that there is a tension between, you know, allowing access and yet keeping people away.
In a democratic society, how do we balance out safeguarding our security as well as our liberty? You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. In this era of soundbite journalism, tabloid television, and corporate-controlled newscasts, are the media adequately informing the public? The question may seem moot in the internet age, when it can feel like information access is unlimited to anyone who cares to seek it out. But because mass journalistic media command a high audience, they continue to play a vital role in our democracy, monitoring government activity, corporate behavior, and the mood of the public. And traditionally, we've relied on journalists to find out the facts.
I always felt that you have one chance in the barrel, and you ought to try to make it good, and pin them down, and let the chips fall.
Helen Thomas, taped here at age 85, is the feisty lady we've seen for years at White House news conferences. She believes deeply in the public's right to know and the responsibility of journalists to investigate. But the title of her recent book, Watchdogs of Democracy, ends with a question mark. The subtitle is The Waning Washington Press Corps and How It Has Failed the Public.
In this serious hour in our nation's history, when we are confronted with grave crises in Berlin and Southeast Asia,
Helen Thomas has covered every president since John F. Kennedy took office in 1961. For many years, she was favored as the first questioner and the voice who would announce the end of a news conference with the phrase, "Thank you, Mr. President." She's still on the job as a Washington columnist for Hearst Newspapers. Helen believes reporters perform a duty to protect our country from unwise policies and untruthful politicians. Those in high office haven't always appreciated her tenacity. And in fact, President George W. Bush declined to call on her at news conferences for 3 years until this exchange in March 2006. At the outset, she put him on notice. You're going to be sorry.
Helen.
You're going to be sorry.
Well, then let me take it back.
I'd like to ask you, Mr. President, your decision to invade Iraq has caused the deaths of thousands of Americans and Iraqis. Every reason given, publicly at least, has turned out not to be true. My question is, why did you really want to go to war? Mm-hmm. From the moment you stepped into the White House, yeah. From your cabinet, former cabinet officers, intelligent people, and so forth. Mm-hmm. What was your real reason? You have said it wasn't oil, quest for oil. It hasn't been Israel or anything else. What was it?
Yeah, I think your premise, and all due respect to your question and to you as a lifelong journalist, that, you know, I didn't want war. To assume I wanted war is just flat wrong, Helen. My attitude about the defense of this country changed on September the 11th.
You've said only a free, unfettered press can save the United States in its most dire moments. How exactly do you see the role of our news media in that unfettered exercise of the press?
I believe that in the search for truth, asking the questions, making every top official accountable for what he does and having to explain it, I think definitely you can stop them from folly in a lot of ways.
Could you give some examples of where you've seen that over the decades of your career as a White House correspondent?
Well, I must say when the message got out on Vietnam, it took a long while. But when it got out, and certainly the reporters on the scene who really were more or less on their own, you know, they weren't embedded, they were out there, they could tell. They could tell that we were losing the war. There was a no-win war in Vietnam, in Southeast Asia, and so forth. And then when Walter Cronkite went, and they said, you can't, you know, this is impossible. And then Johnson, President Johnson, got the message. Finally, he said, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost the American people. It wasn't just that. It's when the press can really do its job, it can tell the truth. Then the American people, when they see the truth, they react. And then they can put the pressure on the White House and on the administration. Nobody is so invulnerable at the White House, even if you don't have to run again. You have to respond to the American people, or they hit the streets.
And do you see this as naturally an adversarial relationship?
Absolutely.
Between the press and those who wield official power?
Definitely. because nobody wants to be asked questions when they take a position and so forth. They're president, right? You're supposed to worship at their shrine. Well, I don't. I think I should question everything that they do on behalf of the American people. But I think I'm privileged to be at the White House and to be able to do that. And I think you default when you do less than that.
You feel you're obligated to question everything they do because otherwise there's a natural tendency for them to go astray?
To get away with it, absolutely. You don't find any questions in dictatorships.
And that adversarial relationship, how antagonistic is it appropriate to get?
I think you can be polite. You can say, Mr. President, and you can say, thank you. What else do they need? Who are they? They're our public servants. We pay them. I really do think that after 9/11, the American press, certainly the press corps covering the White House and the Pentagon, rolled over and played dead.
Did some of our media fall down on the job in covering the lead-up to the Iraq War launched by President Bush in March 2003? About a year later, the New York Times published a lengthy self-criticism stating it looks as if we, quote, were taken in. Several other media have also acknowledged errors. In a democracy, when the country is debating a matter as grave as going to war, the public depends on news coverage to be informed. Historian Kevin Phillips feels many mainstream news outlets lost perspective.
The media conglomerates don't really want to rock very many boats, and a lot of people in the press know that if they're obnoxious, they're not going to get called on in a press conference, they're not going to get somebody high up in the administration to be willing to leak something to them, they'll lose access. So there are a whole lot of things they lose. When you finally get to this stage where the press are finally beginning to realize that the public is really sick of George W. Bush, all of a sudden they can now start to take a little bit freer view and they can not worry so much about you might lose a White House interview.
Let's go back to the point you touched on a moment ago, media conglomerates not wishing to rock the boat. What effect does that have on the actual editorial content of articles we see in the newspaper, broadcasts on the nightly news?
I would say that what you see in the newspapers and on the nightly news is increasingly a corporate product in the sense that it doesn't want to break a whole lot of unnecessary new ground, that it's more concerned about interesting people and maintaining circulation or viewership.
The new suspect in the disappearance of Natalie Holloway, and tonight he's in custody in the Netherlands. The Alabama teenager has not been seen since she left an Aruba bar with three men.
What information are we not getting as a result of these forces?
Well, it's such a huge list. I hate to single out one or two and say these are the great events, but so much detail on so many major important circumstances. For example, there's a outfit out in California called Project Censored. They put out reports on stories that are important that haven't made it in any significant way. And one of the ones they reported was that one of the reasons for invading Iraq had to do with oil, but it had to do with a specific aspect of oil, which was that a number of the Arab countries and some other countries were trying to get away from the practice of using dollars to buy or pay for oil. And the result was that they wanted to use euros or they wanted to use some other currency. And if they had done that, that would have had the effect of taking away the relationship of the dollar to oil, which has been very much supportive of its role in the world currencies. Iran is doing it now, but Iraq was doing it then. And Project Censored suggested that the American people were never told at all about the importance of forcing all these countries, insofar as we could, to only sell their oil for dollars. That wasn't an issue that ever got any attention. But for that matter, the president and Tony Blair in the UK and Don Rumsfeld all said that oil had nothing to do with it. They all said that. Oil has nothing to do with the war. Now, in my opinion, that is a total crock. Oil had a lot to do with the war, and the press has devoted almost no exposés to saying this is what they said. this is why it's not true. There's this whole series of events. Oil was very central, but it's not easy to explain. To do a good job, you've got to take 15 or 20 minutes. People believe it without the real explanation, but you need the real explanation to make people say, well, how could it have been anything else? And the media didn't do this.
Why? Why don't the major newspapers, the major networks, examine the question of whether there is a relationship between the oil economy and the decision to invade Iraq?
Some of the small media were perfectly happy to do it, whether it's an oil newsletter or some small publication. But if you're a major broadcast or print medium, if you're a Time magazine or your CBS News or things like this, if you had done that, you would stand out among all the others who didn't do it, because basically they all pretty much towed the line. They might run some articles about how Europe thinks it's oil, or talking about how the oil companies had sort of participated in strategizing on how they might profit from getting access to Iraq, but they were very quiet about it. In other words, you could hint in an indirect way that people who knew it was about oil didn't want to talk about it. But I can't remember flat-out accusations that this was about oil, not about weapons of mass destruction or not about truth and freedom and justice. I don't remember people frontally saying, no, this is about oil, and weapons of mass destruction aren't the thing that's really motivating the policymakers.
You're listening to Checks and Balances, a Humankind special. I'm David Freudberg. For more information, visit our website, humanmedia.org. U.S. saber-rattling toward Iraq began within months of the horrifying September 11, 2001 attacks on New York and Washington.
People are doing everything that they can to rescue as many people as possible, and this is going to be a long-term effort, so just pray to God that we can save a few people.
And 9/11 cast a long shadow. Veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas believes some reporters felt inhibited from challenging the government as it issued a dire warning about purported Iraqi weapons of mass destruction and an alleged link between Saddam Hussein and the 9/11 attacks.
They played the fear card to the hilt.
Explain how that works, because that's a potentially very dangerous thing in a democracy, to be motivating people primarily by fear.
When you can establish a sense in the atmosphere that if you're questioning anything, you're unpatriotic and un-American, or you're jeopardizing the troops, so forth, that by the challenge and by the question, then you have the self-imposed censorship. It denies us the pursuit of truth.
Now, one of the points that you made in your book was that there has been a pattern of stating falsehoods and repeating them consistently. Have things really gone that far?
Well, all I know is that for 2 years, from the White House podium, I heard Ari Fleischer and then succeeded by Scott McClellan, the press secretaries at the White House, say, 9/11 Saddam Hussein, 9/11 Saddam Hussein, every day, regime change, every day, 9/11 Saddam Hussein. Is it any wonder that anyone in the military would not think that it was Saddam Hussein who had caused 9/11, which wasn't true?
Kevin Phillips.
Well, it was poorly covered in the sense that there wasn't enough examination of the things that were going to make it difficult to succeed, which did make it difficult to succeed. The poor planning, the lack of the bulletproof vests, the poor logistics, the breakdown of law and order in Baghdad, the sabotage of all the oil pipelines in the oil fields. Just everything went wrong. You can fairly ask, what did they think was going to happen? Why weren't they prepared for any of this? Well, the media never really asked what they were prepared for. They were too busy waving the flag and saying, yes, we support the government because Saddam is a bad guy and because we were attacked on 9/11.
And how did 9/11 translate into a less curious, a less bold media?
Well, I think there were a number of reasons. The first was that they really had the sense of the United States being attacked in a whole new way, and you didn't know where it was going, and you had a sense that people did have to rally around. We were attacked on our home ground so conspicuously and so successfully.
Was there a similar reaction, say, after Pearl Harbor? Did the press relax some of its normal watchdog role?
I think probably so. There wasn't a whole lot of media outrage over the internment of the Japanese. But it was also true that Hawaii was not then a state. It was many miles from California. So it was an attack on the United States, but it wasn't quite. And I think that was a difference.
Freedom and fear, justice and cruelty have always been at war, and we know that God is not neutral between them. Fellow citizens.
The other thing that I saw after 9/11 was that George W. Bush had a terrific rating with the public. His whole sort of religious response to it was very well received. And the media would have noticed they were dealing with a president whose approval rating was 84%, 88%. I mean, that's staggering. That makes you feel, if you're in the media, that there wouldn't be much he couldn't get away with, and that you probably are well advised to rally around and not query what they're doing too much. And they did rally around, and they didn't query very much. And the whole notion that the media slept while it turned out we had no weapons of mass destruction that we uncovered, and there probably weren't any since perhaps the early 90s. Well, they were sleeping on that, too. I just think they wanted to believe, they wanted to support. I can give you a horrible example. In World War I, which was massively negative for the future circumstances of Britain and the British Empire, the media were so convinced that the nation's future was at stake that they went along with all the propaganda and didn't tell about how all the mistakes were made in British war planning and about how many people were being killed in the trenches. They basically covered up all kinds of things because they thought, in a sense, national security was at stake. And I think our media have assented to that in this instance too readily. Whereas perhaps in some of the earlier episodes back in the 1970s, they didn't assent to it at all, and they got the sense that the public was angry with them for some of the things that happened.
How is the public going to get better informed?
Well, there's light at the end of the tunnel in one way, but there's also some broken glass right near the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm referring to all the comedy shows.
President Bush is now urging all nations to cut off aid to Hamas in Palestine, including the $234 million we were going to send him. In fact, to make sure the money never gets there, he's putting FEMA in charge, just to make sure that money never gets there.
They have a field day making the politicians look like total idiots. And sometimes they're actually much more revealing about what's happening in the real world than the scared-to-say-anything-very-much nightly news programs. And the extent to which young people watch all these things is really striking. Now, part of the problem is that they've got to pick up a hugely cynical view in the sense that all this is entertainment because these people aren't worth taking seriously. All you want to do is laugh at them because they're no good and nobody can believe them anyway. Now, at my ripe old age, which is Social Security eligible, I think there's a lot to be said for that youthful cynicism. I don't believe most of them either. But on the other hand, you can't train a whole generation to approach it this way and then expect that somehow all of a sudden at 38 or 45, they're going to slip into a different viewpoint.
Let's get back to this theme of checks and balances. The Constitution deliberately established this delicate balance and, by creation of the First Amendment, authorized a free press to also play a role in restraining and scrutinizing the exercise of official power. Do you see that has fallen out of balance? Is that breaking down?
Yes.
Helen Thomas.
I think that definitely. I think when you say it's wartime and so forth, you do get an extra running room. There's no question for any president, but I think he's carrying it too far.
And give us some historical perspective on this. You've covered every president since JFK. Have you seen this degree of latitude exercised before?
I think that in the case of Johnson in Vietnam, he really understood the need to sell, the constant. Speeches were constant of why we were there and what we were doing and so forth. And he was able to do that. These people say, you know, this president says, I'm the president. I can do this.
Mr. Bush came under strong criticism by Democrats and Republicans in December 2005 after disclosure that he had secretly authorized wiretapping of phone calls without the court warrant required by federal law. A news report 5 months later revealed the government had been secretly collecting telephone records on tens of millions of Americans, all in the name of national security.
The terrorist surveillance program has helped prevent terrorist attacks. It remains essential to the security of America. If there are people inside our country who are talking with Al-Qaeda, we want to know about it because we will not sit back and wait to be hit again.
But Bush's one-time rival, former Vice President Al Gore, questioned the administration's methods.
An executive who arrogates to himself the power to ignore the legitimate legislative directives of the Congress or to act free of the check of the judiciary becomes the central threat that the founders sought to nullify in the Constitution. An all-powerful executive, too reminiscent of the king from whom they had broken free.
Monitoring of email, looking over bookstore lists, library lists, if you take a book out. The whole Patriot Act that gives incredible license to intrude into your personal, private lives. And I think the American people are just not aware of that.
Well, some of the polls in response to the revelations that they were sweeping the records of phone calls made seem to suggest that at least a certain portion of the public was willing to forfeit certain freedoms in the name of protecting the country from terrorism. Did that surprise you?
Yes. It told me that I wish more civics and less math is being taught in the schools, more history. I think that's what we're all about, liberty and freedom and our individuality, individual rights.
And practically,
privacy.
What effect does that have on us when our library records can be scrutinized? Our phone records.
This whole Big Brother that we can no longer call ourselves truly independent as a people if we know that the government is scrutinizing everything we do and listening in. There's no reason, he said, to go for a court warrant. When it's all there and it was no dire emergency, he just almost eliminated the fact that they had to resort to a court warrant. All it takes is 72 hours. Courts have been very lenient. If you had really proved there was a true emergency for wiretapping or for anything else, they'd grant it, no doubt. But I think he just gives very short shrift to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, on a lot of things.
That's just such a frightening thought to me. As an American who believes that our Constitution is designed really to safeguard the liberties of the average citizen, for you to be suggesting that he disregards the Constitution.
Well, I think that it's been disregarded in a lot of ways, and I think that it's up to Congress. The very fact that Congress has the sole right to declare war, and that hasn't happened. That didn't happen in this case, and it hasn't happened for many years. So they've fallen down on the job, too. A president can't get away with that if Congress really started to assert its own powers.
What is the dynamic here?
Every branch has defaulted in that respect. And I really think that there is no question that if there seems to be a vacuum, a president will grab more power. And there has to be restraints. But Justice Brandeis said that a constant spotlight on public officials lessens the possibility of corruption, and I feel of power grabs.
And that is the role of the Fourth Estate.
Yes.
When a government sets out to mislead the public, as you feel George W. Bush did with Iraq, what does that do to our democratic society? What damage is done?
I think the country suffers. I think we have lost our way. I think we are rudderless. I think we have lost our halo in the world. We are despised, not because we gave them something and took it away. It's because we represented the best of all mankind. And I think we have really lost our footing, and I want us to get back to where we were, to be revered.
How damaging to our reputation do you feel have been the images from the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, the Guantanamo Bay camp down in Cuba? Those images are widely circulating as part of what America is now.
I can't believe that's us. I think there is so much disappointment and so much shock that Americans would be engaged in such activities. You know, when the president issues a statement, well, they keep saying we don't torture when you got the photographs right in front of your eyes. Because we don't torture. And there it is, the dogs, the naked men, the pyramids, the humiliation. I mean, our whole reputation has been sullied in the world. We've never been put in that category before. And I don't think any American wants to carry that on our escutcheon.
Helen Thomas, veteran White House correspondent and author of Watchdogs of Democracy. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Steve Colby. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with The Network Incorporated. Program development and support provided by Chart Media.
We're distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. And our web address is humanmedia.org.
This segment, part two of Checks and Balances, is Humankind program number 106.
PRI, Public Radio International.